Today we're very pleased to be hearing from John Lindsay, who is an assistant professor of digital media and global affairs at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. He holds a PhD in political science from MIT and a master's in computer science from Stanford. He has also served in the Navy. His research focuses on the impact of technology on global security. He's one of the few scholars that I know who has published both in high-impact political science journals like International Security and high-impact history of technology journals like Technology and Culture. And he recently co-edited a book on China and cybersecurity with Tianming Chung and Derek Rivera. He's currently completing two book projects, one with Eric Gartsky on cross-domain deterrence, and another is titled Shifting the Fog of War, Information Technology and the Politics of Control, on the strategic and organizational dimensions of military networks, drone warfare, and cyber security. And I think we'll be hearing a little more about that today. So please join me in welcoming John. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much for that kind introduction and the invitation to join you here. It's great to be here in this really high-tech room, in this really high-tech building, and I'm not going to use any technology at all when we talk about technology, so I hope that's okay with everybody here. So it's great to be here in an interdisciplinary forum here at the Anoudi Center that and a program that is sponsored by both science and technology studies on the one hand and computer science. The computer science aspect of cybersecurity is critical, but the SDS dimension, emphasizing the social, political, and economic context of technology, is fundamental to, I think, the practice of cybersecurity and our emerging theoretical understanding of it. And it's also great that it is here in an international relations forum. This is an emerging topic, maybe a subfield in IR, but while Donald Trump's 10-year-old son may be really comfortable with the cyber, I think international relations is still struggling to get its arms around what these new technological, social, and economic developments really mean. So, as Rebecca mentioned, this talk will draw a little bit on a book that I just finished and currently revising called Shifting the Fog of War, Information Technology and the Politics of Control. And this book has been gestating for quite a while. In fact, its intellectual and very interdisciplinary origins go back about two decades to my college experience in Stanford, here with Ann Bracey in the second row, in the Symbolic Systems program, where I was very interested in questions of artificial intelligence, the nature of knowledge. Is machine knowledge like human knowledge? If not, why? How might we think about that? And then its practical origins come from my experience in the United States Navy. In particular, my first wartime experience, and I almost want to put that in quotes, although it was a very real war in 1999, this is the NATO air war against Kosovo, where I served as a targeting officer in Naples. And this was a very strange experience for me, having grown up on my father's stories. He served as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam and had many more traditional experiences that you might associate with war, that war in particular. And yet here I was staying in a Italian hotel built on an old Roman bath, eating mozzarella di bufala in the morning, driving to work. We would do our intelligence analysis, present our targeting briefings. We would have video teleconferences, and then we would watch things blow up on CNN. This is a very strange way to fight a war. Look at all the technology that's mediating what's going on. And I started to think about, how do we think about knowledge when it both is highly consequential and highly mediated by increasing layers of technology between the individuals and organizations that are perceiving the world and the world that you're actually trying to perceive or act on. Now, that war was interesting for a number of other couple reasons. It was America's first war in which no Americans were killed. This was a war that ended with no NATO casualties. A couple of jets were shot down, pilots were recovered. It was a very, very high-tech war. Lots of sophisticated sensors, lots of precision weapons, and it really seemed that the United States was a beneficiary of what people were talking about in the 1990s as a revolution in military affairs. The idea that more precise sensors networked together with more precise weapons would allow warfare to be fought more efficiently, more quickly, and would be able to do away with the uncertainty that was had been fundamentally associated with war for thousands and thousands of years. What question, general and scholar Karl von Clausewitz called the fog of war, might finally be lifted by information technology. But of course, that same war also had some spectacular disasters, most iconic of which, of course, would be blowing up the Chinese embassy. A perfect storm of bureaucratic non-coordination, opportunistic targeting by various government intelligence agencies, and with the result that bombs went exactly where they were supposed to, high-precision GPS munitions delivered from a B-2, but those coordinates just happened to mark a building, which wasn't the building that the U.S. was targeting. In fact, it was a building that the Chinese had just moved into a year before. The State Department knew it, didn't let DOD know. People were very surprised, especially when it happened to hit the intelligence cell of the embassy. The kind of mistake that you just can't make up, but investigation after investigation has validated that this was indeed a mistake. Now, that target prior to the strike showed up on a PowerPoint target, which looked exactly like many other targets, had been just as well vetted, in this case, by the president himself, and yet went through. So this really got me thinking about, okay, if we've got this increasingly distributed socio-technical system for focusing people's knowledge about places that are far away, enabling them to intervene in a very precise way, this is not only amplifying knowledge, but it also has the potential to amplify misperceptions about the world. Okay? So the problem is that in the process of lifting the fog of war, we're also shifting the fog of war into the infrastructure and institutions that make that knowledge possible. So a lot of the triumphalism that associated this discussion of the revolution of military affairs really needs to be tempered by the fact that war has not turned out to be quick, cheap, and easy. If any, the most technologically advanced military in the world went to a war with the same stuff they had in Kosovo, but ground down for a decade of really ambiguous, difficult fighting against insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the RMA, the Revolution of Military Affairs, didn't quite work out. And yet there are places in which it did work, and you did see incredible efficiency gains in the way that smaller units were able to act. And when you actually opened up the black box of operations and looked at what was actually happening, what you would find is that servicemen and women were improvising with the tools that they had on hand. They were using things in ways that contractors never intended, with doctrine that they hadn't worked out before their deployment. In many cases, actually writing scripts, if not entire applications, AirSats targeting problems, working with the things that they have, basically hacking the system to extract the value that they could. This has implications for cybersecurity that I want to talk about today. The same things that made the RMA difficult in a military context also should give us pause when we start thinking about the efficiency of cybersecurity on the offense, and maybe some defensive attributes that, if we appreciate the socio-technical context of cyber operations better, might give us a little bit more optimism when we think about these things. Now, the theme I want to stress is a bit of a paradox, and the paradox is embedded in the title of this talk, and that is the increasing danger and complexity in the cyber domain that brings us all together, has created cybersecurity commands, and study programs, research grants, is becoming more dangerous and more complex, but it's happening in a world that paradoxically is becoming less dangerous, where war is less likely. And I want to argue that there is an important relationship between these two opposite trends. So I'll try and explain the title of this talk in five parts. I'm going to begin by reviewing the debate in international relations, maybe giving some of you a different perspective on thinking about cybersecurity, and talk about why I don't find it very satisfying. So that's the cybersecurity part. And then I want to talk a little bit about how we might think about cybersecurity as a set of institutions, a set of cooperative practices. Okay, this is what I mean by design. I'll talk a little bit about why offensive cyber operations in this context are difficult, and that difficulty tends to incentivize restraint in planning those operations. That's the restraint part. Now I want to talk about, given that understanding of offensive cyber operations, where we would expect them to be useful. This is the attenuation of war part. We can conclude and open up for discussion, which I'm really looking forward to. So the cyber security, cyber warfare debate in international relations, both on the academic side and the policy side, has sort of emerged as this stylized debate between what you might call revolutionaries and skeptics. And it really kind of resembles this 1980s Miller Beer campaign, where one side would yell, it's great, the other side says, less filling, and it tastes great, less filling, they go back. Of course, they're talking about the same thing. So the taste great side of this debate, much more common in policy circles, we have arguments that cyberspace is a fundamentally new domain of conflict. And there are a couple of arguments that come up again and again in two categories, a couple of sub-arguments in each of those I'll go through. On the first, there are a few inductive, empirical arguments. People look around and say, wow, cyber attacks are really on the rise. Look at ways of penetrating companies, stealing their stuff, interacting in ways that we never thought was possible before. Second, firms are penetrated, they are hemorrhaging intellectual property. Keith Alexander, former NSA director, described this as the greatest transfer of wealth in history. Third, when we look at major governments, they're really worried about cybersecurity, okay? They are writing policy documents, they're standing up cyber commands, they're spending money on cybersecurity. Clearly, there's something going on here. I'm trying to explain what that is. There are a series of deductive arguments that try to make arguments from the supposed nature of the technology to their military or strategic properties. The first is that the technology is fundamentally, categorically offense dominant. Okay, this is a technology which really advantages attackers against the defenders because the defenders have an expanding attack surface. As more and more societal functions move online or critical infrastructure is dependent on digital technology and it's connected into the internet like it never was intended to be before, while attackers can learn about techniques and download code off the internet at fairly low cost. The second argument is that because of this offense dominance, which includes the ability to maintain anonymity and hide oneself, that weak actors have a particular advantage. Strong actors like the United States, Great Britain, Canada, are heavily wired. If you're heavily wired, you have a large attack surface, you have a lot to lose, you have difficult collective action problems coordinating industry firms, government organizations, especially in a democracy where people are supposed to be able to do their own thing. This makes defense very, very difficult, while weaker actors have particular strengths and little to lose against them. Third, attribution is often thought to be a major problem in cybersecurity. Very difficult to understand who is behind an attack. It might be redirected through a different jurisdiction. It might be a false flag operation. How can you figure out who is really responsible? And if that's true, then deterrence becomes really, really difficult. How do you respond when there's no return address to the attack? How can you credibly promise that you're going to retaliate to no one in particular? Okay? So these two categories, six arguments altogether, come up again and again. On the less filling side of this debate, and this is a lot more common, I would say, on the academic side, whereas the taste great revolutionary arguments are more in the policy and military professional education literature, we have a set of counterarguments. The first are some inductive counterarguments that say, yeah, okay, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's really mainly crime and espionage. There's a lot of crime going on, but it's fairly marginal compared to the great benefits that the information economy is enabling. There's a lot of espionage, but there's always been a lot of espionage. We're just not seeing the digital Pearl Harbors or the cyber 9/11s that the revolutionary crowd has been talking about. Second, while firms are hemorrhaging their intellectual property, they're not hemorrhaging the stuff that really makes those firms valuable. You can steal text, but you can't steal context. And the more sophisticated your widget, the more dependent you will tend to be as a firm on tacit knowledge, on interactions within industries, and that is very difficult to steal remotely unless you already understand what that firm is doing so well, you probably wouldn't need to steal it in the first place. People that are making these arguments will often point to the problems that many countries have when they try to reproduce the Silicon Valley or the Route 128 miracles somewhere else, and they just can't quite get the special sauce combination together of venture capital and recreational opportunities and academia and lots of startup culture and all of the things that exist, but exist in an ecosystem, okay? Lastly, yes, governments are really worried. They're doing a lot, but government and cybersecurity industrial actors have significant incentives to inflate the threat, especially in the last couple of years when we saw in the waning Iraq and Afghanistan years, especially after the financial crash, defense budgets were starting to go down. If you want to arrest that, you need to argue that there's a big threat, that there's a reason to continue to spend. Cybersecurity looks good. Cybersecurity also has a brand new set of constituents within the Department of Defense that cuts across the military and intelligence agencies. The more you can talk up a coherent reason for being, the more reason you have to exist. And of course, on the cybersecurity industry side, we know that a lot of the talk about threats might be reliable, but it also needs to be thought about quite literally as advertising. If these cybersecurity firms understood security well enough to be able to say, this is our product, we're really good at it, buy some security, and the customer could say, I'm going to buy that much security, you wouldn't need to spend all of this money on really good analysis and give it away free. But you want to give it away for free because you want to advertise, we were smart enough to reverse engineer Stuxnet, just imagine what we could do, you know, defending your network. So you've got these kinds of threat inflation arguments. On the deductive side, and these foreshadow a couple of the things that I'll talk about and made a lot of these arguments myself, kind of on this side of this debate. The offense dominance argument really overlooks a lot of the things that need to be done to actually plan and execute a sophisticated attack. And Stuxnet is a wonderful example here because it's sometimes held up as the revolutionary example of how you can use mere code to break something, in this case to degrade the performance of uranium-enriching centrifuges in Iran. But that case also shows that we have an actor that's spending a great deal of time, in fact several years, cautiously doing the intelligence preparation, mapping the facility and the batons, trying to understand it, actually mocking up facilities that look very much like the batons with the same kinds of centrifuges that the United States was able to acquire from Libya. Because everybody in here that writes code knows that you don't write the perfect code the first time. If you don't debug it and test it, you're probably not going to be able to convince the President of the United States to endorse a covert action against Iran. So a lot of effort goes into that. Now, how much effort is Iran putting into defense? Iran pays nothing for the reverse engineering of Stuxnet. Iran pays nothing for the patches that Siemens and Microsoft start to initiate. The initial discovery of Stuxnet is fascinating. Stuxnet is very sophisticated. Four zero days, many vectors that it's exploring. One of the things that it does is it looks to see which antivirus is defending a particular machine. It says, well, if you're ESET, I'm going to behave in this way. If you're McAfee, I'm going to behave in this way. If you're Symantec, I'm going to behave in yet a third way. But who would have looked for a little company called Virus Blockada from Belarus? Because what kind of market share do they have? Well, Iran's under a great deal of sanctions, and they happen to be buying this AV from Belarus, and that happens to get into a conflict with Stuxnet, which starts the reboot loop in one particular computer, which then compromises the entire operation. So here you have the best attackers in the world, the National Security Agency, backed up by Unit 8200 out of Israel, that have made a mistake that compromised that operation and basically started to unravel years and years and hundreds of millions of dollars of work that went into this particular operation. Stuxnet is also interesting because it kind of gives the line to this question about asymmetry. which was the argument that weak actors have the advantage over the strong. Well, this was exactly backwards, right? This was the strong having advantages against the weak. And in many of the major events that we think about, whether it's China exploiting firms, China exploiting human rights organizations, Russia exploiting Georgia or Ukraine, or the US and Israel exploiting Iran, it is stronger and more sophisticated actors that are using cyber techniques as a force multiplier to the power advantages that they already have. Further, attribution is feasible, especially where it matters, because the more sophisticated the conspiracy, the more likely it is that somebody is going to leave a clue. The more careful the parties need to be to not leave things, and the more likely it will be that the aggrieved party is going to initiate an investigation. Especially if they have the resources to look at things other than computer forensic, they've got other intelligence streams that they'll be able to bring into that attribution problem. So ironically, while attribution is very difficult at the low end, where people are less motivated to try and work through the vast number of combinations you might have, at the high end, with high value targets, you have a smaller number of potential perpetrators and more motivation on the political side to do it. And if attribution is feasible, then so is deterrence. Bottom line on these arguments, I think, is that we need to think about the logic of technological possibility together with a logic of political utility. And by that I mean it's not enough to say, given the configuration of this machine, this infrastructure with these vulnerabilities and these potential ways to access and exploit those vulnerabilities, X might happen. That's a logic of technological possibilities. When you show that you can hack an airplane or a car or what have you, that's what we are demonstrating. But you need to be able to take that possibility and weaponize it. If you're going to weaponize it, you have to tell a commander it's going to create this kind of effect at this particular place, at this particular time, or if you're not time sensitive, it's going to, you know, 1, 2, 3. And you have this risk of retaliation or blowback or collateral damage or what have you. Okay, so there's got to be a story of what kind of political or economic gain is going to be realized from that particular operation. So I find the skeptical angle generally convincing in theory, but I've been struck how unsatisfying it is in practice. People that are in the practical cybersecurity business, whether they're on the corporate side or on the government side, almost have this sense of indignation where they say, what do you mean there's not a threat? What do you mean the cyber domain is not an active domain of novel conflict? Step into my shoes, sit in my chair. Every time I kick the Chinese out, they're in somewhere else. APT-28 seems to have this incredible Swiss Army knife toolkit. How can I possibly compete with that? Look at the news, right? It's this litany of ongoing events. And these events are, they're creative, they're often surprising, and the only thing unsurprising about cyber is that, you know, we're surprised about the new dimension that's been opened up. And whether it's the Snowden revelation that the National Security Agency was willing and able to have a much broader scope of exploitation we expected, leveraging US companies on US soil like Google and Yahoo, that's a surprise. Whether it's North Korea being willing to hack a Japanese company on US soil to prevent them from releasing a movie, failing to do so, again, that seems strange, that's a surprise. Whether it's China hacking the Office of Personnel Management, exposing, depending on who you believe, somewhere between 2 million and 30 million government employees, all of their personal information, leading many to believe, hey, this isn't just espionage, this is espionage on such a scale that it's really starting to look and feel different. To, of course, the ongoing drama with Russian interference in US electoral infrastructure. Continuing creative but inevitably drawn out and ambiguous provocations. We make it reasonable to conclude that all conflicts do now have and will have in the future a cyber component. And when you start thinking about more high-end conflict scenarios with China and Russia, some of those can get particularly scary. So given that we've got this taste great, less filling debate that goes back and forth, but we've got all this activity that looks a little bit different than either side is characterizing it, what should we do to make sense of it? So I think we really have a problem here, not just of the facts, although there are certainly plenty of things we don't know, we could learn a lot more if we had better data, but a problem of really understanding what this domain is and what conflict in it looks like. So I want to argue something that might seem a little strange, but I want to argue that cyberspace is an institution, not just that it has institutions like ICANN or ITEF, but it literally is one. And that's kind of political science speak for saying it is a set of coordinated relationships that depend on cooperation. Okay. This is not the way we normally, in pop culture, think about the internet. Eric Schmidt, of course, described the internet as the greatest experiment in anarchy ever. General Hayden, former NSA, former CIA director, said, well, the internet's kind of like Mogadishu. And I want to argue, well, no, this is exactly the opposite. In fact, the internet might be the greatest experiment in hierarchy or institutions ever. We should actually listen to the word that we use to describe this melange of practices and technology. Cyberspace, of course, is not just a 1984 Canadian science fiction writer's fantasy. It comes from the cybernetics movement. And when this word was coined, it was coined from a Greek word meaning steersman, kyber, which is actually the same root for the word government. And the intuition was that cybernetic systems, naval gunfire control systems, digital computers, were somehow doing something very similar to what governments were doing. And if you look at the bureaucratic nomenclature of computer science, it's overwhelmingly about files, processes, procedures, protocols, methods, routines, right? This is the language of being in a large bureaucratized organization. And when you look at the history of the development of computing machines, it's overwhelmingly in corporate and government bureaucracies to expand the scope and precision of the control that these organizations have beyond the capacity of the humans in that with their native minds. Okay? Now, in the discipline of international relations and international political economy, when we think about institutions, I like to use the definition of Douglas North, who won a Nobel Prize for thinking about the role of institutions in economic history. And he defined institutions colloquially as the rules of the game, or more formally, the human-devised constraints that make human collective action possible. Okay. Institutions are overwhelmingly defined by specialization in the functions that people use to implement them, as opposed to true systems in anarchy, where every individual in that anarchic system is helping themselves. They implement functions like measurement to find out, to improve flows of information from the outside world into an organization, coordination amongst the actors in the organization, articulation or enforcement of the intentions or goals of that organization, all to provide joint benefits to the actors that are cooperating to realize them. Most institutions rely on technologies. It's really hard to think of institutions that don't have technologies. Maybe, you know, handshakes or bows might be very simple ones, but any real institution, like a government or a university or a military organization that you think about, has technology along with it, and of course technology has associated institutions. And so if we take North's sporting metaphor seriously, that institutions are the rules of the game, we can think about technology as the equipment in the playing field. And all of these have to go together. All that is preamble by way of saying that computers become particularly interesting in this framework because computers are literally tools with rules, okay? Rules, methods, procedures, programs, all the things we talk about. This is the language of institutions. And if we take that quite literally, we might expect large-scale information systems to be subject to many of the same dynamics that affect any kind of institution anywhere. Namely, we should expect to see struggles over the definition and adaptation of these institutions, because one standard will empower one group over another. So people tend to argue about who wins and who loses in these definitions. There will be fundamental tension between the regulation or decentralization of the institutional rules of the game that you're using to coordinate interaction. And you'll expect layers of abstraction to have different principles of organization depending on what you look at. No market economy is truly disorganized. Total anarchy, if so, you still have to have common rules of the game, common currencies, common courts that allow you to do things. So even decentralized institutions still have these centralized aspects. Institutions tend to have their structures get locked in historically. They have all kinds of inefficiencies if they're not put together in the right kinds of ways. And this allows us to start looking at computing vulnerabilities through an economic lens. And there has been, I think, a burst of really creative activity in the last 15 years looking at the economics of cybersecurity and characterizing things in terms of the economic incentives and disincentives which create vulnerabilities. For example, the failure to build in security in the early internet because nobody took security seriously. They didn't have to. It was a cultural group of scientists that largely trusted one another. They didn't expect large-scale exploitation because they didn't think about what it would mean to have millions, if not billions, of users. Firms that rush to market to sell functionality rather than build in security. You've seen this repeated time and time again. We're going through this again with the Internet of Things. Oh my gosh, again, they didn't think about security. They just thought about functionality. Well, firms don't get rewarded, and you want to be the first to market because there's huge network effects if you are the first one to market. Huge third-party externalities. That means a cost or benefit that's not borne by the parties to the exchange. Okay, so if your computer is infected with a botnet, you get to keep using your computer because you have plenty of bandwidth, you actually don't really care. But it might be attacking somebody else's computer. All right, that's an externality of you not patching, which Microsoft has now fixed. The Internet of Things has not fixed. And so now we're seeing toasters starting to attack websites. All right, people that own the toasters still get to make toast. And unfortunately, someone somewhere else in the world is getting attacked by that particular toaster. So in many ways, we can think about this institution which allows unprecedented improvement in control in the economic, governmental sphere, an unprecedented global institution for improving control and efficiency through common standards and protocols that are still not quite perfect. And these inefficiencies now allow all kinds of exploitations. They allow exploitations in the same way that inefficiencies in other kinds of institutions do, right? So a yellow light is a design feature that's supposed to slow everybody down. When you have something going from green to red, it makes traffic work more efficiently. But of course, some people say, well, not only is it almost not green anymore, it's still not red, and so you speed up. The world becomes a little more dangerous. We all now have to deal with people exploiting yellow lights in this way by looking around a little bit more, so you're piling on a social institution to try and deal with this imperfection that's in the yellow light. Anytime we talk about legal loopholes, right, it's somebody exploiting something in the law that the law didn't ever intend. Because maybe the law wanted you to carry forward some losses that a business had that were in the range of $1 million. And nobody ever thought that you would take a $1 billion loss and spread it over 5 or 10 years and not be able to pay any taxes at all. Okay, that's a flaw in that legal regime which is being exploited. You can also think about the way that criminals or insurgents or terrorists operate within the society that is hosting them. They're not openly resisting or rebelling against institutions. They have to work within them in order to not be discovered, not be found out. So all of this kind of cheating within an institution fundamentally depends on a degree of cooperation amongst the very people that are exploiting it. So part three. So if you buy this idea that cooperation, reliance on common standards and protocols, common abstractions, which are generally good and improve efficiency for everybody, is necessary for making information technology useful, and that exploiting this is actually a form of cheating within these institutions, why might reliance on cooperation in the very means of conflict incentivize restraint? Kind of exploitation that I've talked about does rely on a degree of deception, and this is profoundly true in most places in offensive cyber operations. Offensive cyber operations are not kinetic operations to force your way through a door. They depend on somebody leaving the door open for you or convincing somebody to open that door, right? There is no brute force in cyberspace. A so-called brute force attack is actually just trying a bunch of keys, okay? It's not kinetic brute force. Martin Levicki likes to say there's no forced entry in cyberspace, which means you're relying on technical exploits. And technical exploits means I'm going to use your protocol, your machine, your standards in a way that you, the designer and the firm, did not intend. Okay? There's more variety in the world than you're able to handle, and I'm going to present you something that's going to look normal, but of course is now going to realize an intention which is not in the interest that you had conceived. I'm going to engage in social engineering, which does the same thing. I'm going to take advantage of gullible users, make them believe that we're working together, right? All con jobs fundamentally rely on the cooperation of the mark. You believe you're in a safe place, or you want to believe that you can get a cheaper house or a cheaper taxi ride, right? You participate in the exploitation that makes that con possible, fundamentally different than a brute force mugging. And if there's no cooperation, there's no connection, then there's no target. But deception is inherently self-limiting. Deception can do a lot of things, but the more sophisticated that deception, as we talked about before, the more likely it will be that there will be mistakes made that will compromise that activity. You step out of cyberspace again and think of other places where deception figures heavily. We see a lot of deception in the battlefield, traditional military operations, but most of it are tactical ambushes, feints, diversions. Deception on a large scale, something like the deception before D-Day to try and convince the Germans that the landing is going to be in Calais and not in Normandy, are very rare because they're very difficult to pull off. Because you need to handle all of the information channels that the enemy might have. You need to show them something that's not there, hide the things that are there. And these kinds of gambits have many, many ways to fail. So more sophisticated compromises are more likely to fail. And also, defenders can be deceptive as well. So if there's an expanded potential for deception, those benefits don't just accrue to the attacker. Those benefits can accrue to the defender, too, if you're willing to use it, right? Think about a minefield. A minefield works. It actually provides deterrence because you tell somebody, there's a minefield here. You don't know where the particular mines are, right? There are camouflage. And it's going to take you a tremendous amount of work to actually walk through, this 100 yards. It would be very easy to walk through if you didn't have to deal with this bits of deception along the way. How much more difficult if you actually have to deal with a counterintelligence operation where you're being lured into a honeypot, a honey net, or something else where you're being allowed to be in the system, you're being watched, you're being given bad data because people want to learn about your methods. They want to learn about what your attack platform looks like. They want to see if there's any ability to start exploiting what you're actually doing. This is active deception against the deceivers. And both on the commercial side and certainly on the government side, the increasing discussion of active defense, of hackback, starts to suggest that this more deceptively oriented defense is becoming more and more common. So if cyber exploitation relies on defense, and defense has got some of these problems, deception has some of these issues. Where is deception going to be useful? In international relations, when we think about conflict, we think about kind of two abstract classes of conflictual behavior where conflict is useful. We think about conflict as a form of bargaining, right? We're negotiating something. It's just part of my negotiating strategy might involve using force, right? To coerce you in a certain way. And force can be useful in various ways. The most obvious way to use force is to take something away from somebody or to break their ability to resist or to fight back, okay? You can change the balance of power. You can change bargaining power, right? The second way that you can use force is to communicate information to the other side about what you're willing to do, what you're willing to fight for, how far you're willing to go, that you might be willing to escalate and go further. The difference is that the first form of brute force that changes the balance of power is working right now in the present, whereas the communication of information is talking about, this is what I care and this is what I'm willing to do for. So deterrence, which is trying to stop something from happening, or compellence, which is trying to start something into motion, both of these are communicating. So how useful is deception for both of these? Well, deception has its limits when we start thinking about coercion, right? Using deception to communicate. There's an intrinsic contradiction here. A lot of the pessimism about deterrence in cyberspace comes from exactly this problem, right? How can I credibly advertise to retaliate if I credibly reveal what I'm doing and then people just patch the vulnerabilities or close the vectors that I'm going to rely on? Now I'm just saying something might happen. Well, that's not as credible as saying this will particularly happen. Well, that means it's also increasingly difficult to coerce somebody to do something using deceptive means. Now, there's lots of caveats and asterisks on this. Ransomware is, I think, a really important kind of exception which proves the rule. In ransomware, the attacker encrypts your machine and says, hey, if you want to get access back to your data, you need to pay me so many bitcoins to this address. And if you do, then maybe they'll unlock your computer. The fascinating thing is they often actually do. But there are real limits to how far that can go, because if the ask is too high, you as an individual user might say, well, I already backed up my data. I don't really need it. I'll just go buy a new machine. If you're a corporation or a government, you might say, well, I'm going to start an investigation. I'm going to call the FBI. I'm going to get things in motion. Okay? And now the perpetrator is starting to have to worry. Did they leave clues? Is there something else that's going to come out? Right? Relying on anonymity to make threats is really difficult because how do you surrender to no one in particular? So cyber is not very useful for communicating information, which is very ironic because this is an information technology. And this is one area in which its informational uses are not very pronounced. Now, on the other side, the brute force, or what I like to call revision of the balance of power, this is where cyber really comes into its own. Okay, this is crime where you're looking to steal some resources, or it's intelligence where you're looking for an informational advantage by learning about somebody else's capability or their bargaining position. It might be manipulating narratives, propaganda, activism, or it might be actually using them in a warfighting mode to trip capabilities. But as we go through that list of things that you might be able to do, there are increasing operational barriers to getting those right. And I won't go through all those in depth. We've already talked a lot about them. But basically, the more you expect to get out of a particular attack, the more you're going to have to put into it. There's no free lunch anywhere. We expect it here. If you want to break a cyber-physical system without getting caught, without facing retaliation, it's going to take a great deal of preparation and all the other capabilities to make that happen. Even on the low end of crime, we know that if you actually want to turn that hack into money, that takes a great deal of effort. And this is why you can buy all kinds of perfectly good credit cards and bank accounts in online hacker forums that are being sold for pennies of the dollar, right? Here's a credit card, it's got a $10,000 limit, and I'm going to give it to you for $5. Well, what the heck is going on there? Well, there's $9,995 that are being discounted, because actually translating that into money is the hard problem. You got to come up with some sophisticated laundering scheme that depends on mules and ATM cards or little creative deposits that go somewhere else, and that's really the hard part. So all of these have these additional barriers to operation and monetization and political usefulness that are added on as we increase the scale of the attack. So I think in many ways, this is kind of why we have this taste great, less filling debate, is that when we focus on the low end attack, the low end scale, we do see a great deal of offense dominance, if you will, of weak actor advantage, of creative activity. But when we look at the most worrisome scenarios of Cyber 9/11, Digital Pearl Harbor, we see both strategic disincentives in the form of deterrence, and we see operational barriers in actually getting something done. Okay. So just to wrap up here, in the next 10 minutes, what would we expect to see where would cyber operations be most likely? Talked a lot about kind of the growth of cyberspace and the political cooperation that makes it possible, but the other big trend in recent decades is the gradual lessening in the frequency of armed conflict. That may seem a little insane when we look at the Middle East melting down and some really horrific things happening in Syria, but the big picture is pretty clear. You have far less interstate conflict than we ever had before. A lot of that was replaced with civil war, internal war, insurgency. Even that is dropping down. Steven Pinker is famous for writing about this, but this data has been interrogated and reproduced in other different kinds of studies. But we have kind of this general attenuation in frequency and intensity of warfare. Now, there's a lot of different explanations for this. These explanations may have little to do with cyberspace, they may have a lot to do with cyberspace. It might be the case that greater US conventional and nuclear power just reduced the attractiveness of war to most actors that would have the power to get involved. It might be that better monitoring of the balance of power give people a better idea of what's at stake and fewer places to hide, and therefore if you can't hide, there's less incentive to go to war rather than make a deal. It might just be that there are better alternatives to war for getting the kinds of things that people used to fight over, right? Increased economic interdependence on a global scale just means it's easier to trade for stuff than to fight for arable acres to make it yourself. There might just be more robust cosmopolitan civil society. Some people like these ideas. I'm not arguing that cyberspace causes any of these, although it's interesting to note that cyberspace is correlated with all of them, correlated with increased US power, correlated with economic interdependence, correlated with the ability to talk to people around the world. But for whatever reason, as traditional war becomes less attractive, war in cyberspace becomes more attractive. Politics doesn't stop. People have fewer incentives to actually resort to force. They are more involved in cooperative institutions. So what's left is the complexity of that institutional landscape and the imperfections of that institutional landscape that can be exploited for small marginal gain. So here's the paradox, is that as war becomes less attractive, cyber conflict is becoming more attractive. And in many ways, this recalls this old idea from the Cold War of the stability and instability paradox. And this was this idea first advanced in the 60s that nuclear war is bad, both sides understand it's bad, they both watch Dr. Strangelove, they don't want to end up like that. Nuclear weapons are clearly destructive, dangerous, ghastly, you can't defend against them, everybody knows the other side has them. You have mutually assured destruction, which means it's not rational for either side to go to war. But for the same reason, you can't credibly threaten to commit suicide just because somebody is doing something annoying in El Salvador or Vietnam, right? So you have a proliferation of small-scale conflict below the threshold of nuclear retaliation. So you can have nuclear stability and conventional instability. I would argue that because of several changes in military power, we now have general conventional and nuclear stability, but a great deal of gray zone, cyber, and other forms of instability, which allow these more minor and constrained forms of conflict to really proliferate. So, conclusion, cyber conflict is not a new form of warfare. In fact, it occupies a more middling position between peace and war, between military and civilian affairs, between hierarchy and anarchy. like intelligence, like irregular operations, like coercive sanctions. And in that world, states become more important, not less, because they're the trees around which these institutional systems are built. Conflict looks a lot more like the kinds of conflict we see in trade regimes, right? Arguments about how institutions are designed, who benefits from the distribution of given rule sets. It doesn't look like a conflict in anarchy, right, where you have two different opposed autonomous hierarchies going at it. Cyber and international security, more in the category of irregular operations. It looks like intelligence, it looks like counterintelligence, but on an unprecedented scale. Again, this middling position between war and peace, between anarchy and hierarchy. There are a couple of interesting caveats to this in the world of cross-domain military operations, which we could discuss in the question period, but I won't go into now. In general, because of the downward vertical pressure on conflict, on large-scale warfare, you have this ironic increasing horizontal proliferation in the variety and the creativity of different kinds of conflict. So I think this allows us to move beyond this light beer, taste great, less filling debate, maybe to a more satisfying pitcher half full of some quality craft brew, where we say, the half empty part is, yes, cybersecurity is dangerous, frustrating, complex. It's a problem that's going to be very difficult to solve, maybe is unsolvable. But the half full part is, it's predicated on things going pretty well on a civilizational time scale. So we've got war, we've got conflict looking more complex, but not necessarily more dangerous. So I'll wrap it up. I'm really looking forward to your questions.
Thank you very much for a great talk. So I have a question on the stability, instability paradox that you brought up, and I'm giving myself away as an IR grad student here. So with regard to the idea that stability at the nuclear level helps proliferate instability at a lower level, which at least from what I understood is a cyber level, I've been sort of reading up a little bit on the United States' cyber doctrine, and there's a task force report from the Pentagon in 2013, which sort of says that, you know, if there's a cyber attack, it should be regarded as any other attack, and that the United States needs to engage its deterrent force, including the threat of a nuclear strike against would-be cyber perpetrators. And I'm wondering here whether the line that we are sort of clearly drawing between the nuclear level and the cyber level, separating them, is in fact a lot more blurred than what it appears to be. And so I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, great question. The argument is not that there's a super clear line, it's that there's a boundary that is put in place because of the clarity of deterrence at one level, which is not credible at another level. The only reason that you would want to have ambiguity in a declarative deterrent policy is because you have a credibility problem, right? If you tell your kid, hey, please stop beating up Jenny, or maybe I might think about possibly, taking away your dessert. Well, Bobby's going to say, well, I'm going to maybe get the dessert and keep beating up Jenny. So, you've totally undermined Europe. So, if you can say absolutely, hey, no dessert, if you don't stop beating up Jenny, great, Jenny's going to be okay. Everybody gets dessert, we're all happy. The problem is, how can you say, if there's a cyber attack, there's going to be a response? Nobody can say that because nobody's quite sure about that threshold or wants to commit to that threshold for a number of reasons, including that the U.S. wants to be able to do its own cyber attack. So, you're going to introduce ambiguity to deal with your own credibility problems. And this was the same in the Cold War, right? The fundamental puzzle of nuclear weapons is they're unusable, right? You can't threaten to commit suicide for anything because it's worse than any possible benefit. So what you have to do is threaten to put things in motion that might be really, really bad, right? Schelling talks about starting to rock the boat. If you spill the boat, capsizes both passengers, but you're just rocking the boat, you're just upping the risk. And that risk essentially discounts the severity of the threat. So that's what ambiguity in this case is doing. If a cyber attack is really, really bad, somewhere up there, there's something that might happen. You're trying to deal with the fundamental non-credibility of dealing with that. The way to separate this, stability, instability in its classical and its current formulation, they depend on where the clarity of deterrence lies. And it lies at a higher level in the nuclear realm of the Cold War than I argue now, even in the conventional realm. But because cyber is really useful for all of these low-level revisions of the balance of power and moving benefits around, and not useful for deterrence, you've got a blossoming interaction. So it's constrained not just by deterrence, but also then by its relations and cooperation.
So we need to ask the speaker to talk about something he hasn't talked about in the talk, but you did have a sentence in your chapter that you gave us, which I want to ask you about. Most of the sentence summarizes the way you concluded, where you say, limits on the severity of conflict brought about through major improvements in the military control capacity of leading states will tend to encourage an expansion of the complexity and subtlety of conflict. That I take to be another way of saying what you said in your conclusion. But there's a minor clause at the end of the sentence. Comma, together with ambiguous, if not outright marginal, political economic effectiveness. You didn't talk about political and economic effectiveness. You certainly didn't talk about economic effectiveness. Could you say something about that, or do you want to refer me to the book when it comes out?
I refer everyone to the book when it comes out.
I've got to get there myself, which is why this conversation is really, really useful. What I was alluding there, actually, is follows up perfectly with the previous question. I wanted to argue that this interesting cyber paradox we have is not simply a function of deterrence, as in the stability and instability paradox, which is just because there's no consequences for going to a certain level, I'm going to go to a lower level, and that's just fine. I think that does apply, but there's this additional reliance on cooperation and the gains to be had through connectivity and all of the positive pro-social uses of the internet, which also impose a restraint. So you've got kind of a doubly restrained environment where both deterred from going to a higher level of intensity, and there are benefits from continuing to interact, which are then going to moderate the level of deceptions that you're using.
So the Russians try and hack the Democratic National Committee's emails, and they come up with some not very important stories that have a short-term effect on the American election. Does the story end there, or in responding to that, does President Obama or his successor, whoever she may be, respond by saying, we're going to up the ante on those lousy Russians? We're going to make sure they understand that there are consequences to what they do, and that may create a feedback loop to the beginning of your theory, that is to say, it may have an effect on the severity of conflict.
Yeah, okay.
It may be that in responding to these subtle and complex signals, governments or actors in general may up the ante, and then you may increase the severity.
Yeah, okay, so there's at least three different pieces to that. One is, you know, what are the Russians doing? Does it make sense here? Two is, what could be done in response? And three is, does that start to increase mistrust and create a conflict spiral where you would eventually have the result to more kinetic violence? Is that?
Yep, that's
right.
The question.
So this is a fascinating case, and I really like looking at, from east to west, the four big episodes of Russian cyber activity from Georgia, Ukraine, Estonia, and the United States, a little bit out of order temporarily there. But in all four of them, you have a vigorous contest of propaganda and narratives. In three of them, you have some fairly large-scale denial of service attacks. In two of them, you have the use of clandestine special operations, and in one of them, you have a full-scale military invasion. Okay? So in the place where Russia cares the most and is most confident that there will be no response, hey, they use all the force they need to get what they want done. That's Georgia. Ukraine, a little bit less because you're a little bit closer to the NATO boundary. You still care about it more than NATO does, but you're still a little bit more restrained. Estonia, actually part of NATO. You're pulling your punches even more. The United States, you're doing some very annoying and controversial things, but in the context of a great deal of existing U.S.-Russian tension, existing U.S. sanctions and verbal rebukes to Russia for its activities in Ukraine. So I think Russia is fairly confident that it can do these things and get away with it. Right? Basically saying, well, the United States, what are you going to do? Now, does that feed a conflict spiral that can eventually end up in some Baltic scenario? That is certainly possible, but any Baltic scenario, or on the Chinese side, South China Sea scenarios, these would certainly have some cyber involved, but it's cyber involved between powers that are already willing to risk military confrontation. And then cyber is interjecting a little bit of uncertainty in a particular way. So that's kind of the cross-domain caveat that I'm talking about, where these restraints that I think are very real within the cyber domain, when combined with other domains and a willingness to risk real military conflict, could have some different effects. And we can talk about that in really specific ways if you want.
Thank you. I'm right behind you.
Okay, so really fun talk. I really enjoyed it. But so far we've been talking about state actors.
Yeah.
When we talk about the stability and instability paradox, one of the primary means of fighting it out in the Cold War is the use of third parties and paramilitary organizations to act as proxies. So where are our third parties, where's WikiLeaks in our story right now, and how does that affect the possibilities for continued sort of kind of glass half full stability in the cyber realm?
Yeah, well, I think the proxies are everywhere. I mean that just as a pun, but the reason that we keep having all these surprising interactions is because there's some third or fourth party that is now getting co-opted, exploited, involved in a way that wasn't quite appreciated, that wasn't under an explicit or implied protective umbrella, right? This is why North Korea is willing to start risking it with Sony, still very tentative, still trying to obfuscate its identity, but, it's sat there and it's watched China hammer Fortune 500 firms for the past 4 years, and nothing has happened. And, the U.S. government hasn't even called out China by name. So it's feeling that if it really hides, and we're only talking about a movie, maybe we can go ahead and risk that. WikiLeaks, another great example. So, I think that you have this looking at possibilities that are not well defended, and they're not well defended precisely because nobody's decided to very particularly clarify what they're willing or able to do implicitly or explicitly. So the glass half empty part, increasing complexity, increasing actors, increasing interdependence, I think proxies are a huge part of this. So we should expect to keep getting surprised. We'll all have lots of good employment in the future.
Adding on to the discussion about non-state actors, recently, I think China and America, there was President Obama and the Premier got together, they had a little chat, and they said, okay, let's stop the cyber attack thing. But given the independence of a lot of these proxy actors, how much do you think these states actually have control over the proxy non-state actors that conduct these things? For example, how much influence does Russia actually have on the WikiLeaks, or like, can they control them? Can state actors, when they promise, we don't want to do cyber attacks anymore, can they actually enforce that onto their underlings?
China case, there's a great deal of control. I mean, especially since a lot of that was, state sponsored, conducted by the Chinese People's Liberation Army. Some of it was moonlighting on the side, and certainly an ongoing military reorganization that only partly had to do with these negotiations in September last year. A lot of that has been cracked down on. Okay. Getting governments to agree not to spy on one another is like promising somebody you're not going to lie to them. It's a really difficult proposition. Important, worth pursuing. The first time that we've ever had anything that starts to approach a norm about espionage, even though it's about only a really small part of espionage, like corporate commercial espionage. That's the first time that's ever happened, right? There's never been international law or norms that have touched espionage. But what appears to happen is not that it's gone away, but that China has switched to the more technically capable actors. And instead of having 3PLA, which is the Chinese NSA, doing lots of stuff to lots of people, a lot of that activity is switching to the Ministry of State Security, which is kind of like the Chinese CIA. It's a foreign intelligence organ. And you've got some really good technical sophistication. Those are the guys that Microsoft turned over its Windows source code to. So they are still very active. China has been forced to up its game and not get caught as easily. Remember, we only caught the NSA because of Ed Snowden, right? A couple of other things. It wasn't for Ed Snowden, there's still a lot of stuff that wasn't known. There just weren't as noisy. So I think this norm against espionage has just forced people to get better at espionage. And get caught was the real message. There's another part of the question.
I'm just more worried that, we have this idea that there's a boundary, as you said, between, total escalation and then the lower end, like lower intensity conflict. I'm just worried that these, at least in the case of China, as you said, these state actors do have a control, but in cases where the state has at best a tenuous control of non-state actors conducting these things on their behalf, is there a risk, a real risk that these proxies...
Well, this is where the operational boundaries... The boundaries to operationalization really come into play, right? So those non-state actors that are motivated by whatever reasons, they have the motivation but not the ability. Those that have the ability because of all of the planning intelligence complements don't have the motivation. And that doesn't seem to be changing.
I see. Fred
Schneider. My understanding is that the way mutually assured destruction is argued, it depends on both sides believing the other side has sufficient control so that it could launch a retaliatory attack under almost any circumstances. That's why we have those submarines out there. Yet if it turned out that the control systems for these counterattacks were heavily dependent on networked information systems, then the success in cyber attacks would compromise either your belief or your belief that the other side believed you believed. And the whole argument behind mutually assured destruction goes away. Richard Danzig calls this mutually unassured destruction, or MUD, MTD. It seems that, therefore, there's an interaction between cyber and what used to be a nice world order that... is rather disturbing. Maybe you would tell us where that fits into.
Yeah, I'm very glad that you brought this question up. I mentioned a couple of times that there are some caveats and asterisks, and this is a really big one. This is another one of these exceptions that prove the rule that from the same argument, we can get into a really bad place. Actually, my colleague Aaron Karski and I have a paper called Total Nuclear Cyber War that's coming out. Both of us have been on the kind of skeptical side, hey, cyber war is overblown. Then we got together and said, but there's this one exception. And the one exception is hacking nuclear command and control. And the reason that's a huge problem is back to this question, why do nuclear weapons work? They work because of transparency, right? I know and you know that these are terrible, ghastly weapons that kill lots of people in ways that are very difficult if not impossible to defend against. So you can parade them through Red Square, you can put them, you can advertise them, and that advertisement helps to make deterrence stable. And yes, you need to secure a second retaliatory strike. Cyber is exactly the opposite, right? Depends on deception. You can't reveal it. If you reveal it, you lose it, especially in nuclear command control. If you were to tell somebody that had nuclear weapons that their command control was compromised and not do anything about it, they would fix it. So you can't mention it. So now here's this terrible situation where I know that your nuclear command and control is compromised, but I can't tell you because then you would fix yourself, which means you think you have a deterrent. Because you think you have a deterrent, you're willing to run some significant risks, believing that I'll back down. But I know that you don't have a deterrent, and the balance of power is in my favor. So I'm willing to run risks that you're not willing. And so we're both rocking the boat, believing that our resolve is greater than the other one. This is a huge problem because it gets at exactly this problem that nuclear weapons are useful as political signaling weapons, cyber is useful for changing the balance of power. Most of the time, you would expect that that would put a bound on the intensity of cyber, but if you're already thinking about starting a nuclear crisis in the cyber world, that's a huge problem. And it's not total fantasy, because if you look at this program from the Cold War in the 1980s, which we found out about after the wall came down, East Germans had penetrated NATO, and they found this program called Canopy Wing. And Canopy Wing was this massive, multi-pronged electronic warfare program aimed at Soviet command and control. It was going to use electronic warfare and Voice of America and all of these things to confuse, put in disinformation, and try and create these counterforce capabilities. So you can only imagine that in the digital world, you would do the same kinds of things. The people at U.S. Cyber Command tell me I shouldn't worry as much about that because there's lots of redundancies and the Russians are still on analog anyway, big 12-inch floppy disks, but the theory of deterrence is certainly undermined if you're hacking nuclear command.
But there's there's another way to look at it, which is equally depressing. If you know that you've penetrated your adversary's command and control, then if you think about it for a second, you realize that you might yourself have been penetrated because, after all, they're pretty smart and you're smart.
Yeah.
And now you're living in a world where you believe that you don't have this control and you realize that they'll go through the same thoughts and realize that they don't have this control. And now nobody's prepared to depend on the automatic retaliation. And now you're tempted to make first strikes preemptively because that's the only option you have rather than being annihilated. So there are at least two instabilities that are possible once cyber can be penetrated. It's hard to know how people are going to think, but it seems to me this is a very broad undermining of, I mean, this is at existential threat level, and it undermines all of our strategic thinking about deterrence at the nuclear level.
So I mean, that could go in a lot of different ways. I mean, if we suspect or have evidence that you're penetrated, then you know that you're weaker than you thought you were, so you're not willing to run as much risk. That same thing, if you found that something was going on, that might make you a little more cautious. But if it was going on and you still had control, but you thought you were going to lose it, you might not have this use it or lose it mentality, which then becomes a problem. Yeah, I think that this is a major problem. We don't even have to talk specifically about the nuclear side. We're talking about a high-intensity conventional conflict, and you've got cyber means in there. That could also accelerate your willingness to go first, because you believe that if you're going to use cyber to blind the other side's radar and command and control, you need to use it quickly, and it's only going to create a temporary window. Once you've got that window, you need to jump through it. So you may be acting faster than you would otherwise. Both sides believe this. As we know, both the Chinese and the Americans are all really excited about network warfare. So there could be incentives to move fast in a crisis where both sides are already thinking about militarized conflict. So again, this falls into kind of that cross-domain aspect that I was talking about. But yes, we're talking about cross-domain interactions between, militarily capable competitors. I have lots of worries, and so does U.S. strategic community. And I think they should. But that's very different from the big cyber debate that animates a lot of other discussions.
Yeah? Well, first of all, thank you for a really interesting talk. And I'd like to ask you about the role of the public view in assessing or thinking about the severity of the cyber threat, in that you could have a low-level cyber attack that shows public fear and confusion like we had with the OPM hack, and then that puts public pressure on governments to respond. So does the public perception and confusion, lack of familiarity with cybersecurity, does that make the ambiguity of cyberspace more dangerous than if we only think about government signaling to each other and communicating with each other?
I mean, so far we haven't seen any kind of public pressure to respond to that kind of activity. I mean, what is that activity saying, right? I mean, is that activity saying, hey, this is the beginning of something that'll follow, or is that activity said, this is as much as I'm willing to risk right now because I don't really want to go further, right? So when you see that kind of activity, is it provocative, or is it actually signaling a certain amount of weakness, right, and unwillingness to go further? So there's that ambiguity that I think people need to take into account. But there just hasn't been much public pressure because people don't feel the impact in any direct way. And there's still a lot of good things that they're getting from the relationship with whoever the perceived actor is. So there just isn't the call to do something, you know, other than a kind of infotainment sense.
Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. I have myself next. So you.
Village of the chair.
So you've talked a little bit about deterrence, and you're skeptical that cyber deterrence is going to work because of attribution problems, because of I don't think you mentioned this argument, but the use it or lose it argument, that once you've used a weapon, it can be reverse engineered, and then it's no longer useful. So by the time you prove your your weapon, it's no longer actually a threat. And I'm wondering, on the other hand, you know, your talk also emphasizes that for any high-value target, there's actually a very labor-intensive and sort of skill-intensive process going on. So if we were to refocus on the skills and say it's the skills that are the weapon and not the technology that's the weapon, does deterrence become more plausible? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. So there's... In response to that question, there's two different kinds of deterrence, and one of them that really matters. You know, I think this concept of general deterrence, which is a way of preventing people from challenging in any way. And then there's immediate deterrence, which is getting someone to back down from a challenge that they've already made. I think that this kind of dependence on skills and institutions is fantastic for general deterrence. And I think that the Snowden revelations are fantastic for U.S. deterrence. Now, a lot of U.S. officials don't like it when you point this out. You can see glimmerings that Admiral Rogers actually agrees with this, even though he will point out immediately, we lost all this tradecraft and that's bad, bad, bad. Well, he's an intelligence officer. Of course, that's what he's going to say. Intelligence officers want to spy. They don't want to deter because deterring is a very public thing. But Snowden basically said, here's a lot of stuff we did, and maybe now it's all gone. But there's more where this came from, and the smart gals and guys that made this stuff still work for us, and they're still putting this stuff together. And so... beware, that probably exists. Stuxnet similarly, right? Oh my gosh, like, there is a country that is willing and able to put all of this stuff together. Can't be sure that it's not going to be used. It's going to be out there. But in the immediate situation, where I'm like, okay, you have provoked me, and I'm going to explicitly say, hey, no further, or X. Well, that or X is still going to have that technological component. It's going to include, in order to make it credible, some vulnerability, some vector, which is going to give you some information about how to shut this down. Right? This is why the Japanese can't announce where they're coming from when they attack Pearl Harbor. They might want to use a core somewhere, but they can't because it needs to be a surprise. That's still dependent on a great deal of skill. Right? Carrier warfare is incredibly difficult, but in the immediate situation, they couldn't use it. And by the way, I would say this general deterrence turn and kind of the value of the Snowden and Stuxnet, we can really see that reflected in this pivot that is happening right now in Chinese military cyber doctrine, right? It's very clear that they've gone from this doctrine of, like, net warfare is the awesome, you know, enabler of the weak to, like, holy crap, we are really vulnerable to the United States.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I don't think I see any further questions, so I think it's just time to thank you for...
Matt
is somebody.
It was actually a follow-up, thank you, Sid, to the question on public opinion. And,
yeah.
And I wonder if you underestimated a bit, maybe because you're lucky enough to live in Canada and maybe aren't paying quite attention to
to what's going on in our political debate, but we did have the president declare that there would be a response to Russia's cyber intervention in the U.S. electoral process, and we had a Democratic candidate accuse her opponent of being a Russian stooge for celebrating that intervention in a way that makes us think she thought the public would react favorably to that. She mentioned it several times in the debate. So when you suggest that you don't see a public responding in the way that Naomi thought they might and potentially exacerbating the situation, is it just in the minds of our politicians then, and you really just don't see the public caring about that? But if they did, how would that complicate the situation?
Okay, well, so my answer to her question was, you know, trying to take the state out of it. This is a situation where the state is very much in it, and it's the state which is making this so egregious and difficult. I'd say the difficult and frustrating aspect of these interactions are still kind of within the realm of this glass half empty propaganda, disinformation, intelligence, counterintelligence on an unprecedented scale, you know, that I was talking about. So I would still, unfortunately, expect to see that kind of stuff and expect to see more of it. So this brings us into the state-to-state realm. You know, what is the response going to be? Now, it'll be probably be proportionate. It'll be, you know, sub rosa, maybe. You'll hear about it, maybe you won't. It'll be kind of the same sort of stuff that happened with Korea, where you'll be like, well, you know, we may or may not have shut off your lights, and we've sanctioned a few of your officials, and I understand you're already the most sanctioned regime in the world. So this isn't necessarily going to hurt, but we've at least shown that we're doing something. Okay? So the Russian response, which has had lots of hemming and hawing associated with it, will be sort of similar, right? Because there's only so much that you can do to Russia, because there's still a lot of stuff that we're worried about Russia doing. So something will be done, but it will still be very restrained, because we want to say, hey, we're not just going to roll over and take it, but we're not also going to push back that hard.
I apologize. Did I miss anybody else? Okay. Wait, was that a yes?
No, that was not a question.
Okay. Well, with that, I want to thank you very much for a very interesting talk.